B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the guy using your member number at the snack bar, Charlie Nance.
Welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. Well, the Players' Championship is come and gone. And what a great finish. You've heard me say this many times before, that for my money, when he's on his game, there is no one in the world that is better than Rory McIlroy. There are times when he just makes the game look ridiculously easy, right? We'll get thoughts on the TPC and the upcoming first women's major, the A&A Inspiration, from Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com and the Golf Channel. But we begin, as we always do, following the biggest professional golf tournaments by picking the brain of golf historian Peter Kessler. Quick plug, if you're a fan of this game and its history, you owe it to yourself to bookmark and visit his website, peterkessler.com. His encyclopedic knowledge and unfiltered opinions, I find them to be both educational and compelling, so it's always a thrill when I get a chance to catch up with my friend like I did this week. Peter, I was hoping we would get past this. Tim Fincham was obsessed with it. I hoped Monahan would back off, but it appears that NBC and the Golf Channel have their marching orders in terms of nomenclature to just spout the TPC as the beat-all, end-all. Why do we even play the other four majors? This is the tournament. Why don't they back off of this? It's a nice tournament. It doesn't even have the strongest field in golf that they claim it has. What is the deal with this?
Well, I mean, the whole thing is completely incestuous, you know, from the commercial money grab to treating people poorly at major championships. You know, I mean, I've gone to so many major championships, particularly PGAs and U.S. Opens, where you see people standing in line for several hours to get on a bus to travel a mile or two for another couple of hours. Kiowa comes to mind. It's a single-lane road.
I'm already having nightmares about Kiowa in a couple of years for the PGA. I'm already having nightmares.
And you can't see anything at the golf course. There's no spectator viewing. So the whole thing is completely insane. And the guy who owns it is in cahoots with the PGA. And it's just a money split. It's completely about the money. Nobody takes advantage of the American golfing public like the PGA and CBS, for example. It's an onslaught. It's an unrelenting onslaught of commercials and essays and videos. So the whole thing is incestuous. And the business with the Players' Championship is so absurd because there's one thing that happened that elevated the Players' Championship this last week, and that was who the winner was, Rory McIlroy. Nothing will elevate your event more than having a great player win it. So everything they did, the saying 17's the most famous hole in the world, it's a nothing hole. They all have wedges. The green is twice as big as a normal green. It's completely flat. And now they have bumper rough around all the edges so your ball can't roll into the water. Same way they've done it on all the par fours and fives. There's a little strip of bumper rough on the edges of the fairways to keep your ball from running out into the pine straw, which is exactly where it's supposed to go. It's almost like six-year-olds going to a bowling party and they put the bumpers up so there's no way to screw up. You would think this was a tournament for promising 10-year-olds. The golf course is terrible. It was really good when it was first built in the early 80s, and I enjoyed going to play it. But now it was harder then. But now it's complete nonsense. They're trying to make it appear as though it's Augusta National. The only thing that they've done right at the Players' Championship is to limit the commercials on the weekends to sponsorship, which is presented by, instead of ads, which is commercials. So if the Players' Championship can go commercial-free, than every tournament on tour can. We know the Masters does it. We saw the Players do it. Now it has to happen on regular TV. And the PGA of America and CBS need to get together so we don't watch that Rolex Omega commercial 7,000 times that they showed a few years ago with Rory McIlroy. So it's a complete money grab. Monahan has no clue as to what's going on. He doesn't understand the issues with the rules. He doesn't understand the issues with slow play. He doesn't understand the issues with anchoring, which they're still doing, both on your left forearm, Kuchar, Bryson, and guys anchoring on their chest clearly longer, and McCarron. It's all cheating. It's all so the product is getting really unattractive because there's no great players playing golf. Rory's the closest one. He could break through. You pick up another major and get to five or six, or you win the Masters and complete the career slam. It's a completely different deal. But right now, he's on his perhaps way to greatness. Nobody else comes close. There's not been a great player this century who started playing golf in this century. That's why they're losing viewers. They don't have guys who can win a lot of major championships, and they don't have anyone who competes regularly like Jack and Tiger used to do. It's a problem.
Peter, before we get on to individual players, I want to stick with the course for 1 second, and thank you for bringing up 17 at Sawgrass and Augusta National. The notion that the par 3 17th at the Players' Course at Sawgrass is the most famous hole in the world is completely absurd to me. It's not even the most famous par 3 in this country. For example, no one's going to be able to tell me who rinsed the ball at 17 in 2 weeks. However, everyone will be able to tell me about the ball hanging up on 12 when Freddie Couples won in 92 at Augusta. People will remember Jordan Spieth kissing away a Masters a few years ago by rinsing three balls at 12 in Augusta. The 12th hole at Augusta National is the most famous par three in the world, period, end of story. Am I right?
Oh, yeah, there's no question about it. And, you know, the reason is, forgetting one's a major and one's a tournament, it's the quality of the hole. Now, on 12 at Augusta National, the depth of the green is only one club. The depth of the green at the 17th, the Players' Course, is three clubs deep, and they're only hitting pitching clubs. At least at Augusta National's 12, you do see some 9-irons. You do see some 8-irons to a very small landing area. So it's a great golf hole. Forget the history for a minute. Forget that exactly what you said is right, that we remember Jordan's balls in the water and Tom Weisskopf making a 13. Yes, I mean, it's iconic for many, many reasons, including players making great twos there when they needed to go on and win the championship. But it's a super golf hole. 17 is silly. It's a pitching club to a green that's twice as large as any green at Pebble Beach. And it's completely flat. And now it's fringed with rough, so your ball can't even go in the water. Why is that interesting to anyone? If they were hitting 5-irons, talk to me.
Golf historian Peter Kessler is our guest taking Dead Aim. Let's get back to Rory McIlroy for a second. This is unfair of me and probably wrong of me, but I always try to look at players and find a comparative player in the past, and I've always kind of wondered who exactly I could compare Rory McIlroy to. Tell me if you think this is an apt comparison. I think he's Greg Norman. I think when he wins, there's a flair, there's a panache to his game that no one else has. However, he's also prone to completely shooting himself in the foot and killing himself at tournaments, too. Is that an apt comparison?
I have one I like a little bit better, Charlie, even though that's fairly close in my mind. But I'd say he's more like Phil Mickelson for a few reasons. Greg Norman was number one in the world for 331 straight weeks, second only to Tiger Woods. So what that meant is that Greg was regularly there on the weekends. You know, Greg could have a really good season of showing up on weekends and being competitive, but ultimately in majors not closing enough times. He only won two. Now, Rory McIlroy has four majors and Phil has five. Phil's whole career has been built upon two or three good weeks a year, unlike Tiger Woods, who was built on 16 or 18, and Jack Nicklaus, 16 or 18 good weeks a year. So Phil is a very iffy player who's prone to disasters, all of the things at the U.S. Open and other championships that he kicked away for various reasons, all of which were his fault, makes me feel like he's more like Rory, because Rory, too, does it like two or three weeks a year. He hasn't won a big tournament. I mean, yes, the Players is a big tournament, especially if a good player wins it, but it's not a major, and he hasn't won a major since he was 24, and he's going to be 30 in May. So to me, he's more Mickelson-like. He's got twice as many majors as Greg. He's only 29 years old. He doesn't have those kinds of collapses with huge leads that we've seen Greg do, but he's not as consistent as Greg. So to me, he's more like Phil, and he's more like Phil in terms of number of championships. They have 9 together, and Greg's only got 2.
Peter, you bring up Phil Mickelson. I don't know how to say this. Phil has a pattern in his life, both on the course and off the course, it seems, of always searching for an edge and an advantage. A few years ago, I thought he was in deep, deep trouble when the feds met him on the 18th hole, and basically they wanted somebody for insider trading more than they wanted Phil, and they let him go. His name was really associated with this bribery scandal recently about kids getting into college. At some point, I guess he's at a point, it's like he's not going to listen to anybody, but at some point, is it possible that Phil's luck is going to run out as far as associating with all of these sketchy individuals?
Oh, I think so. I think it's already run out. I think we're going to find out that this business with this fellow Rick Singer, who was personally and corporately indicted for mail fraud and a number of other criminal-related activities relating to getting kids into colleges by creating false documentation and false paper trails and bribing coaches to say these kids are on the crew team. And Phil worked with the Rick Singer's company for 3 years. Now, that means when he started working with Rick's company, the two of his kids were like 12 and 13 and the other one was 15. What you be doing with that company for 3 years? This guy is being indicted and is going to go to jail, as is Lori Loughlin, and dozens of parents from around the country are going to be brought in for criminal proceedings. If Phil Mickelson, over those 3 years, paid a fee that was greater than $5,000 or $10,000 in aggregate for the 3 years, then that's problematic. If it was 4 figures or a maximum of 10 for 3 years of work at $75 an hour, helping to shape apps, saying, you know, you should do this after school thing, I could buy that, even though I don't really, but I could buy that. But my suspicion is it's a really big number. I also understand that he quietly, and I don't know if this is true, it's what I have heard, and usually I don't say anything unless I know it to be true, but I have heard that he filmed a short on-camera video for Rick Singer's company, which Rick is using to send to other wealthy and famous parents around the world in hopes to get them as clients. When you do an ad like that, that has a huge value. If he agreed to do that for a car company and created an on-camera ad to be sent out to rich people all over the world to buy the car, he'd be paid $5 or $10 million. So the value of his endorsement to Rick Singer is worth an extraordinary amount of money. I'd like to know exactly how that endorsement worked out. I'd like to know the fees that were paid, and I'd like to know what work he did for two kids who were in sixth grade at the time to talk to them about college applications and shaping their future for 3 years. Every other honest family in this country does it honestly. I had 3 kids. We filled out 3 apps and then went to 3 colleges. Something like this, where you would bribe people and pay people to help you through the process. The Mickelsons need help with the process. The whole thing has such an unsensational odor. It really makes me sick at this point. I know Phil, and I'm trusting that he's going to come out with an explanation, and he's going to provide a paper trail of all of the bills and all of the receipts for us to see so that this goes away. The more he doesn't tell us what really happened, the more this thing is actually going to continue to fester and to hurt his reputation to the point where it's unsalvageable.
Does he have enough goodwill built up with so many media outlets that no one will go digging?
Oh, no. Are you kidding? People are going to be all over this. I chose me, excuse me, to pretty much break the story on social media. Excuse me, and to say the things to you that I've said today. I was the one who said, you know, what did he pay and how much did he pay and why was it 3 years and what's going on here? But I don't see any journalistic investigators on the case, but they don't always talk while they're doing the investigation like Mr. Mueller is doing with Donald Trump. They don't show their hands. So I'm guessing that there's an investigation going on. There's a lot of reporters interested in this. They may be outside of the world of golf. But that doesn't matter, and that may be a good thing if somebody who doesn't have a personal stake in the outcome by being involved with the game is looking into it. So I think they're looking into it, and I think there's trouble on the horizon.
That's golf historian Peter Kessler, and when we return, Peter takes dead aim at some of the top players in the game, where they rank historically, and their chances to make impact moving forward this year. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
We're taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And we continue now with golf historian Peter Kessler from peterkessler.com. Peter, I want to talk with you about a few names as we leave the TPC and start moving ahead towards Augusta. And I want to begin with Tommy Fleetwood. I keep hearing what I think is the most absurd statement ever surrounding Tommy Fleetwood, and that is, you know, he needs to learn how to win over here. Are you kidding me? You shoot the low score. I don't care where you are, unless you're talking about playing links golf, which they do not do every week over on the European Tour. It's the same golf game. Most of the courses they play are American-style golf courses. Is that as absurd as I think it is?
It's also silly. You know, it's like sports psychology for golfers. There's no such thing as that. It's a complete racket. I mean, I have a good friend, Gio Valiante, who is a psychology professor at Rollins College. He's now a sales motivational trainer in New York. He worked with Vijay Singh briefly, and Vijay gave him a lot of credit when he had a good year. He worked with Justin Rose when Justin won the U.S. Open. I do not believe there is such a thing as being able to say to a great player, I am a professor of psychology. I've never been a professional golfer. I've never closed out a golf tournament. I use my skills to help people sell stuff to people who don't want to buy it on Wall Street. And now he's hooked up with Jordan Spieth. And the whole thing is a complete scam. All of them are a complete scam. From Bob Rotella's Golf is Not a Game of Perfect. There's no such thing as any of that stuff. That's not how golf works. There's no way you can tell anybody other through their own hard experience of how to work your way into a golf tournament and be able to par the last four holes. You know, and Gio is going to be with Jordan Spieth at my golf course this week, where Gio happens to be a member. And I can't believe Jordan's buying into it. I can believe that Gio's going to take advantage of it because it's good for his career. But to me, I don't think there is any such industry as any of that. I think they all steal from each other. I mean, Gio stole from Joe Parent. You know, the whole thing to me is a slimy underbelly. Great players like Jack and Arnold and Bobby Jones. You're going to sit with a guy who's a sales trainer in New York and have him tell you how to play better golf when he's never even played better golf, nor is he even trained as a sports psychologist. I mean, just some of this stuff just boggles the mind. But Tommy Fleetwood, yeah, it's completely insane. They don't play any links golf in Europe, dude. The links golf is on the coasts. Nobody lives on the coasts. The only one who grew up playing links golf was Colin Montgomery. Everybody else ended up playing exactly the same courses as you described. American-style golf courses or parkland golf courses, but not links style. There's no such thing as learning how to win over there. You learn how to win, and you just keep knocking a door, and finally you close one. He's won in Europe. All it is a location change, same game, same clubs, same idea. Can you put it close to the hole? Can you make a bunch of them? So there's nothing about learning to win in America. It's a complete nonsensical statement.
Peter, I think we all got spoiled. In fact, I know we did, between Jack and especially Tiger in my lifetime from, what, 97 all the way up until 2013. We just got used to the number one player in the world. When he was in position to win the golf tournament, he went out, he slammed the door, he left everybody choking on his dust, and he won the golf tournament. I want to love Dustin Johnson. I do. In today's modern golf world, he's going to the Hall of Fame. He's got 20 wins. Not my Hall of Fame, but he's going. And on Sunday, I watched him, you know, go 3-under through his first 5 or 6 holes, and I said, all right, this is what you do if you're the number one player in the world. You come roaring from behind, you post a number, and you watch people fold like a cheap suit. And he just didn't get it done, and he doesn't get it done as many times as someone with his prodigious talent should.
Oh, it's, the whole thing is so preposterous. I mean, you know, the tournament he won in Hawaii last year, his average distance to the par fours for an entire week was 86 yards. That's a lob wedge. He averaged 86, so that means sometimes it was 100 and sometimes it was 60, but it was always nothing. The rest of the field averaged 114 yards in, so that's a gap wedge instead of a lob wedge, or maybe it's a full sand wedge for some guys. It makes golf completely uninteresting. I don't find Dustin particularly cerebral as a golfer. I mean, people used to say that Arnold wasn't very bright. He was a lot brighter than people thought, and he knew how to close golf tournaments. You know, Dustin Johnson, to me, half of his wins are basically meaningless. Yes, he has one major. Good for him. Get to 5, and then we can talk about it. He's already in his mid-30s. He's got 20-1. To me, that's not good enough for the Hall, but yes, it puts you in the Hall. Hall of Fame is Vijay Singh, 34 wins, 3 majors. Tiger, 80 wins, 14 majors. Phil, 44 wins, 5 majors. You know, Ernie Els with the 4 majors. Those are the 4 guys from the last era. The rest of it's a complete nonsense. Jim Furyk's a lovely guy. He's won 16 times with a major, and he's almost 50 years old. To me, that's not Hall of Fame. That's Hall of really nice guys who did pretty good in times where there were players who were significantly greater. So, I just find this business of characterizing today's players as great when you have a guy who's won 20 times in one major and doesn't close a lot of stuff and isn't really reliable on the weekends and majors. To me, that's just he's so talented that winning a bunch of them by accident and a bunch of them by playing good and knowing he was doing so at the time.
You and I have talked before about the watering down of the Hall of Fame, and you already brought up Jim Furyk. That was the next name I was going to give you. One thing that I have noticed, or maybe it's the romantic in me about the game of golf, is the golfing gods tend to give their players of note one last really good walk in the sun, whether it was Hogan's last stand at Augusta, Jack at Augusta in 98. You can make the argument Phil when he won the Open Championship, maybe Tiger when he won the Tour Championship this last year. All the greats or the really popular guys. It seems Julie Inkster at the U.S. Open at Pinehurst a few years ago, you get that last really good walk in the sun. And I felt like that's what we got with Jim Furyk. The sun wasn't out, but he got that last great round in at TPC Sawgrass. Again, he's a name, like you said, 15, 16 wins. He's got a major. You'll hear, oh, he's a nice guy. He was a Ryder Cupper and a President's Cupper. He's probably going to the Hall of Fame without much questions asked. Where does he stand to you, historically speaking? Is there a comparative player, you know, from Nicklaus's era or maybe further back that is Jim Furyk?
Tom Kite certainly comes to mind.
Great comparison.
You know, here's a guy who had 19 wins and a major championship. He was actually very competitive week in and week out. He was the first guy to put in a 60-degree wedge into his bag, so he got really good inside of 75 yards, which served him well because even then, before the long ball was the long ball of today, there was still a disparity between the longer hitters and medium-length ones like Tom Kite. So, to me, it kind of falls into that thing. He's not a particularly interesting fellow. He's not somebody you casually root for. He doesn't look particularly good on camera. Furyk's swing in particular is awkward, but I happen to like it. Kite's was more traditional. But I would compare him to a Tom Kite, somebody who stuck around for a really long time, was there on a lot of Sundays, got himself around 20 wins, picked up a major, I see that being more of a Furyk-like comparison interpersonally and in terms of the sight of him on a television.
Get you out of here on this. Peter Kessler, golf historian, is our guest taking Dead Aim. I've saved this last name because he's my favorite. I'm unabashedly a Tiger guy. He may be one of my top three favorite athletes of all time. I've been fascinated by Tiger in this comeback in a couple of respects. Number one, I think he's a walking medical miracle. I know I've seen what they did to his back. I don't know how he's doing what he's doing. But as I watch him play, there's moments, on one hand, I really like his golf swing and what I'm seeing. I'm seeing him more on balance throughout the golf swing than maybe I have since the early 2000s, to be quite honest with you. But I'm just not seeing that deadly accuracy with the short irons that I was spoiled by with Tiger Woods. And I'm just wondering, do you think he has enough in him to perhaps contend one more time at Augusta or in some of these majors coming up?
Oh, to contend? I think he does, yes. I think, you know, it's almost like the Dustin Johnson thing in a different way. You know, that Dustin's so talented, he's got to win some tournaments, you know, even though, you know, he's just doing it on, you know, I just showed up and this is what happened. Oh, and I'm the winner. With Tiger, yes, I think he certainly can contend at Augusta. Even if he doesn't play well, you can be a little more wayward there, and he certainly knows the course well. But you have got to, Mr. Woods, be starting to make stuff inside 15 feet again. To me, I see that as the biggest problem. His iron play has always been better than anybody else's whenever he's been on tour. And I don't know what the greens and regulation stats are right now, but I know that he's certainly the top, one of top three best iron players, let's call it that, from all distances, and one of the three or four greatest that's ever lived with an iron club in his hand, always been his greatest strength. And so I think that even now, at this age in his early 40s, he certainly can compete at Augusta. Then they're going to go to Bethpage, you know, where, you know, he's won before. So that's a good sight for him, and he's won the Open at Pebble. I was there that year. And then they're going to Port Rush, where nobody has an advantage, really, other than Rory, who set the course record of 61 when he was 16 years old. But I think he can contend, and I think he could win. But I haven't seen evidence of the kind of golf required on Saturday and Sunday late afternoons from Tiger to be convinced that he can put the thing all the way down to the floor and close the deal out. I think he still looks stressed to me. He still looks worried to me. To me, he looks like he's trying to concentrate, but I'm interpreting that as worry more than concentration. You know, I know certainly in the last 10 years at majors right away, particularly U.S. Open, he would press right from the first tee and hit that block. And the whole thing right from the very beginning was a question of just trying to scrape around pars and not make an early double. And, you know, that pattern. So the stress level he feels is what I think is keeping him from just relaxing enough to remember that he's Tiger Woods and that if he thinks he's swinging good, then, yeah, he can probably win. I doubt the level of his self-confidence at the moment. You know, I'll give you an example very quickly. When I left the Golf Channel, it took me a while to realize, you know, that it was as hurtful as it was. I didn't really think about it that much. I just kind of went on to the next thing at the time. But I think there was certainly a period after that where I wouldn't have been capable of the performances that I generated at the Golf Channel. And so as time passed, it came back around again recently, many, many years later, when I decided to try to do something with myself to reintroduce myself to my old audience and introduce myself to new ones. You know, you have to have your confidence level up. I mean, to sit in front of my camera here in my study, you know, and play rock and roll songs and make up songs about the Masters and the Players' Championship, you have to be, you know, a 10 on the 10 scale for confidence, a 10 on the 10 scale of I know if I like it, everybody else will like it. And then, you know, the confidence to go ahead and bang it out and to make sure that you're on key and that You don't play an intro to a song that you actually start to sing as you play a note. That's a very hard thing for even great pros to do. That's why there's an intro, so you can hear the note that you're supposed to come in on. When you start cold on a song, like Hey Jude or Your Mother Should Know, those are all first note songs. You've got to hit the note right from the beginning. Now, in their case, they've just been playing the song 50 times, so they know the freaking note. I'm on camera, I'm waiting 50 seconds because I'm talking, and then I still have to hit the right note of the first chord that I play, or it's not going to work. So that's where Tiger needs to be. He needs to have his confidence where it's 10 out of 10, and that he knows if he does what he's able to do, if he's a 10 out of 10 in confidence, then that's going to be good enough, just like my work. I know if I'm good with it, everybody's going to think it's better than anybody else's. I never question that. And it's true for Tiger. If he does his best work, it'll be good enough to win. I don't know that he has the confidence to allow it to take place. That's my fear.
He is a must-follow on Twitter, at Peter Kessler. And again, the website, peterkessler.com. Golf historian, the inimitable Peter Kessler. And up next, the opinions of a past recipient of the PGA's Lifetime Achievement Award in Journalism, Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com, as he takes dead aim at the TPC and the first major of the LPGA season, the A&A Inspiration, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
Are Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Ron Cyrak is a past recipient of the PGA's Lifetime Achievement Award in Journalism, and he joins us now. Ron, historically speaking, who is Rory McIlroy to you? This weekend, it occurred to me that he's not Tiger. Because Tigers seem to win almost in a devastating, dominating fashion. And Rory seems to win with flair. To me, in my lifetime, he's Greg Norman. How do you see him?
Yeah, he's sort of close to being Greg Norman-like. What baffles me about McIlroy is I think when he's got his A game, he's the best player in the world.
I do, too.
But what he doesn't seem to be able to do is win when he has less than his A game. I saw some positive signs at the Players that he might be turning a corner there. You can usually tell when he hits a bad shot, his shoulder slumps, he walks with his head down, he gets down on himself, and he wasn't really doing that at Sawgrass. So, boy, we saw Tiger Woods win with less than his A game a lot. You know, Tiger never gave up, always kept grinding, and I want to see more of that from Rory. I want to see him really be that grinder. As I said, I always thought Greg Norman was the best driver of the golf ball I ever saw, but McIlroy is the best driver of the golf ball, and he just got to learn how to keep grinding when he doesn't have it all going for him.
One thing that I will say, and that this is something that's always bothered me about him, he's been a tremendous front runner. If he has a big lead, most of the time he just puts it out of whack. That's been his move in big tournaments and major championships over the years when he's had the opportunity. But he's never been one that could come from behind and kind of close things out when he had to. Case in point, I think, what is it, up until this last weekend, the last seven times he'd been in the final group, he hadn't been able to pull it out, as recently as Bay Hill. But I love the way he closed on Sunday. He birdie after Furyk made that great birdie, and we'll get to Furyk in a minute, but that great birdie on 18 to get to 15 under. Rory birdies the 16th like he should. Then he pars 17, which in that situation, we know how hard that is. But then only Ricky Fowler in my lifetime on that day where he was uber hot. Have I ever seen somebody step up on the tee in that situation and hit that gutsy right to left draw over the corner of that water at TPC Sawgrass like Rory did? It was just, it was a swagger move. It was a confidence move. And I love the way he closed the door.
Yeah, he has full confidence in the driver. It's the strongest club in his bag. I remember covering the British Open at Royal Liverpool when on the 17th hole there was out of bounds on the left side, and I was walking the golf course, but I had the BBC in my ear on the radio, listening to them, and they're saying, "Oh, he's going to hit," because he had a couple shot lead. Said, "Oh, he'll hit iron off the tee here and play it safe," and he took out his driver and hit it about 345 down the middle of the fairway. So he has total confidence in that. And you're absolutely right. I was at Congressional when he won the U.S. Open by 8 strokes. When Rory has his A game, he can overwhelm the field. What he didn't seem to be good at doing in the past, and he sort of did this at Sawgrass, is to hang in there in a tightly contested match down the stretch. And, you know, Fury put pressure on him. Fleetwood was putting pressure on him, and until the very end, he had pressure, and he hung in there. And he didn't start that round out really well. He had to sort of fight his way back. And, in fact, neither of the weekend rounds did he get off to a good start. But unlike in the past, he didn't give up. Remember at the when he was with, I guess it was with Patrick Reed in the final pairing at the Masters, and on the second hole he had about a 5-foot eagle putt and he missed the putt, and you sort of knew right then and there that Rory was done for the day and he never got back on track. That might be the corner that he's turning now. He might be better at getting the wheels back on track when they come off.
Thank you for bringing up missed putts. Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com and the Golf Channel. Really, the ubiquitous Ron Cyrak is our guest taking dead aim. On the subject of missed putts, maybe it was just me, but I was watching with a group of people. And when John Rahm and Tommy Fleetwood both missed par putts on number one, In my chair, I felt the wind come out of the balloon, and I said, they're done. And Fleetwood came back and put some pressure on late, but I never got the idea at any time during Sunday after they missed those two putts on the first hole that either one of those two guys was going to win. Did you feel that way?
No, it did feel like they were not quite ready for that moment. Now, I'll tell you what. And, you know, I mean, Rahm impressed the heck out of me at the Masters. And I think that those two guys, one of those guys, either Rahm or Fleetwood, is going to win a major championship this year. And I think both of them have the kind of talent that they could each get to be number one in the world at some point. They are both very dynamic, aggressive, and charismatic players out there. Rahm probably's got a little bit of a temper thing he's going to have to deal with, and Fleetwood's got to learn how to play over here and how to win against the stronger fields here. But you're absolutely right, and it's true. I mean, with Fleetwood too, Fleetwood's another guy. You know, he started feeling the pressure as early as Saturday, and we've seen that from him before, where he plays really, really well Thursday, Friday, then got to the weekend and backed off a bit. But both of them have enormous talent.
Current number one player in the world is Dustin Johnson. And for my money, when it started out and he was 3-under through his first 5 or 3-under through his first 6 on Sunday, I sort of looked around and said, well, this is about to happen. He's gonna go off. He's going to get through this front nine, go off on the back nine, and get in the clubhouse and watch everybody fall by the wayside. And that did not happen. And it sort of reminded me, Ron, that we were so spoiled for 20-plus years with Tiger Woods. We just got so used to the number one player in the world acting like the number one player of the world at all times. And really, I don't know if it's – I guess it's an era kind of like the mid-'80s where we had Nick Price and Nick Faldo and Greg Norman and Sandy Lyle. And, you know, we had a lot of guys who would come and go near that top spot, but no one really asserted themselves. I think that's kind of where we are right now in that we've just got a lot of really good players, but we don't have that guy.
Yeah, we feel like we're in that period between Nicklaus and Woods, you know, and you know, those are generational players, and they come along, you know, once every 20 years or so. And I mean, gee, Remember when Rory McIlroy was going to be the next Tiger Woods? Remember when Jordan Spieth was going to be the next Tiger Woods? When Justin Thomas was going to be the next Tiger Woods? We had a lot of people come along, and what all this should do is make us appreciate Tiger Woods even more and really appreciate what he did. We have, to me, it's exactly like that period between the 86 Masters when Nicklaus won and the 97 Masters when Tiger won, where you had Greg Norman and Nick Price and Ernie Els and Nick Faldo and Curtis Strange and all these really, really, really good players, but not that overwhelmingly dominant player. So there's a different kind of excitement out there now. There's a whole bunch of guys, Dustin Johnson and McIlroy and Justin Thomas, Justin Rose, when they're going out there and they got their full stuff, any one of them could be the best player in the world for that particular week, but not necessarily build upon it week after week after week the way Tiger did.
Yeah, you know, I think we all need to really tap the brakes before we get excited and start predicting so-and-so is going to win 10 majors, so-and-so is going to win 12. There's a reason why the table of men who have won double-digit majors is a very, very small table. It's really hard to do, and you have to be that generational player to pull it off. And, you know, I don't know if we call Dustin Johnson a generational-type player, but my gosh, has there ever been someone who was more quiet to 20 PGA Tour wins that you've seen?
Yeah, because he's really, you know, until recently, Dustin was the kind of guy, and he probably did this about the first 7 years of his career. He'd go out and he'd win once, you know. He'd win every year. He'd go out and win once, but he would never build on it. And, you know, go back to a few years ago when he took the 6 months leave of absence to deal with personal issues. I think, you know, and maybe it was meeting Wayne Gretzky around the same time, but something clicked in his head to make him realize that that window of greatness doesn't stay open forever and that his chance is now, and he's got to take care of that opportunity now. And it really seems like the last 3 or 4 years that he's been playing with a renewed sense of purpose. And he also worked on some of the weaknesses in his game, particularly his game from 100 yards in. He's a much better at that right now. But I do think something lit a fire under him a few years ago to where he realizes that this is his moment and he's got to take care of it now.
Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com, the Golf Channel, and assorted other media outlets. He's everywhere. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Jim Furyk, by today's standards, Jim Furyk's going to the Hall of Fame?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, he's got enough wins. He's got a major. You know, he's been a good Ryder Cup player, and I think he's going.
I believe that golf, and it's because you're able to play golf, you know, past your 30s and still be competitive. I believe that the golf gods allow our champions one last walk in the sun. You and I have talked about this before. One of my favorites was Julie Engster at the Women's Open here at Pinehurst. Had that wonderful Saturday where she turned back the clock and was Julie Engster at the U.S. Open again. And, you know, Nicklaus, 98 at the Masters, Hogan, 67 or 68 at the Masters. Everybody gets, the great ones get that last great walk in the sun. And I really enjoyed what Furyk did on Sunday. The sun was not out, but he's a grinder and a great professional golfer, and he and Fluff Cowan took that last great walk in the sun. Maybe not, but maybe so, and it was punctuated by just a brave and bold birdie on the 18th hole.
And how quick did he start walking after
that? Oh, I loved
it. Like, as soon as the ball left his club, he knew that he had flushed it perfectly, and he just started walking right after the ball. That was pretty cool. You know, Jim's one of those guys who, you look at it, Kuchar's kind of that sort of player without the major, but who was in contention almost every time he teed the ball up. You know, he drove the ball extremely well, and he putted the ball extremely well, and those are two good things. I was surprised it took him as long as it did to win a U.S. Open, because it did seem like the U.S. Open was made for him. And you can see Sawgrass is a good course for him, because you got to drive the ball in play at Sawgrass, and he's really good at that.
Let's shift gears a little bit. We're a couple of weeks away now from the first major in the ladies' season, the A&A Inspiration. And before we talk about that major, I want to talk about something that I know has bothered you, and it's bothered me since it was announced. As excited as I am to see women's golf on television at Augusta National, I really can't wait just for the visual, the optics of that on television. The one thing that does bother me is the A&A Inspiration has always had a history, dating back to the Dinah Shore days, of inviting the top amateur golfers in the ladies' game to compete at that major championship. It was one of the things that the amateurs really looked forward to. And this thing at Augusta National is scheduled for, I think, the Saturday of the A&A Inspiration. So you're not going to have that great amateur field at the A&A. How does Mike Wan feel about this? Is there something that can be worked out between the men of the Masters and the LPGA Tour? Because there's something about this that I don't like.
Well, you know, this is another example of where I would like to see all the constituencies in golf work together better, you know, and not step all over each other so much and really try to coordinate their schedules so that they don't have events butting up against each other. You know, the A&A Inspiration was already hurt a little bit by the drive, chip, and putt contest because media started arriving, on Saturday at Augusta so they could cover that on Sunday. Well, that took some of the national media away from covering the A&A Inspiration. I think the A&A's at a point now where it's almost certainly going to have to move to a week earlier. You know, it moved to the week that it's on now to get away from the Players' Championship back when the Players was originally in March. And then right after they moved the Players to May. But I do think that they're up against not just that weekend before the Masters stuff, but that's Final Four basketball weekend, too.
Oh, yeah.
And now, to move the A&A a week earlier, I think it means you've got to move both of it. You can't just flip it with, like, the Kia Classic. Because I do think the tour's now been, you know, it opened in Florida, then it went two in Australia, one in Thailand, one in Singapore, and it just comes back to the States now. I think you need at least those two domestic events before the first major of the year, and that's what we have now. We have Founders Cup, then Kia, then it goes to A&A. So I think you still want two domestic events before the A&A, but I think the LPGA is in a place now where, for a bunch of reasons, and losing the amateurs, as you refer to, is one of them, but they're going to have to move that tournament up a week and get it away from the Masters.
As a journalist, are you going to Augusta to cover the amateur event for the first time, or are you going to the A&A?
I will be at the A&A, and then I will get to Augusta on Monday, actually. Yep.
Ron Cyrak of RonCyrak.com and assorted other media outlets. He's everywhere. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Get you out of here on this. This part of the year is the part of the year where I have to sort of wrap my head around where we are with the ladies' professional game, because they spend a good chunk of the first part of this season overseas. And I'll be honest, I don't follow it as closely as I should. Where are we with the ladies' game? What are the big stories as we're heading into the first major?
Well, you know, the ladies' game is in a very similar position to the men's game, which is, you know, first five tournaments of the year won by five different players. We had a switch at number one. We started the year with Arya Jutanagarn as number one in the Rolex rankings, and now it's Sung-Hyun Park is edged ahead of her by, like, two-tenths of a point. So there's an enormous amount of parity there. But I do think that it's going to be interesting to see. The Arya Jutanagarn Sung-Hyun Park rivalry could be a real fun thing to watch. They're two really enormously talented players. But the other questions that are there is, you know, is Lexi Thompson very famously took a month off in the middle of last season to try to reorganize her personal life. And will all that, and then she won the last term of the year. So, you know, is she got her ducks back lined up again to take a step forward? And then it seems to be the perennial question we have every year is, can Michelle Wee stay healthy? And she's already had to withdraw from one tournament this year with a reoccurrence of the soreness in her hand that she had operated on in October. I think those are some big stories. Here's the other good storyline that I think's out there is Nelly Korda. Nelly Korda, it could make a run at being the best player in the world now. She's won two of her last six tournaments has been in the top 10 in all of those events and is playing really, really well and has surpassed her sister, Jessica, in the world rankings. So she's in the top 10 right now. And you probably wouldn't guess this, but she's the second highest ranked American behind Lexi Thompson.
From RonSirac.com, the Golf Channel, and so many other media outlets. He's everywhere these days, it seems. That's Ron Sirac. I'd also like to thank golf historian Peter Kessler for his time, insights, and opinions as well this week. A reminder, a great way to stay in the loop with us is to be a regular consumer of our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. And weather-wise, well, oh my gosh, could spring finally be here once again for the second week in a row? It looks like we may have spectacular weather in the Carolinas. To tee it up and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy. And I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.